hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network with NPR Illinois Community Voices. I was going into my classics introduction there for a second. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, and we are getting close to Oscar time. Hard to believe it, even though this is going to be an elongated Oscar period, but the Oscar films are starting to come out, and thanks to our good friends at Netflix, we have been able to take a look at the film Mank, directed by David Fincher, and so we have many, many thoughts about this, and this is kind of fun because we have three different hosts from three different shows, so we have a wealth of film expertise and opinions coming at you today. So I have here first with me, Brett Rutherford from Beyond the Mouse. How's it going, Brett?
I'm good. Good to be here. Thank you.
Awesome. Awesome. And I also have with me from Flashbacks, Jay Hoffman. How's it going, Jay?
It's going great. I'm glad that my hobby that involves me sitting on a chair has made me an expert.
Well, when you sit and talk about movies for as long as we have, you might as well become an expert at some point.
Success.
So, yes, we are talking about the film Mank, directed by David Fincher, which I believe drops on Netflix December 4th. So depending on when this drops, it might be already available to you. But, you know, if not, you only have a few days to wait, so it's not that big a deal. But this movie really is about the, not necessarily the life, but a specific period in the life of Herman Mankiewicz, a screenwriter during the Golden Age of Hollywood, one of the co-writers of the screenplay of Citizen Kane. And I've seen a lot of advertisements of this film talking about this being the making of Citizen Kane. This is not a making of Citizen Kane film. The making of Citizen Kane is kind of the backdrop of this film, but it's not at the forefront. And we will get into that. But before we get into necessarily the details of the film, we're going to do about 10 minutes of just non-spoiler opinions. So in case you haven't seen it yet, you can listen and go and watch it and then come back. But Brett, I will start with you. First of all, I don't think it's a necessity to have seen Citizen Kane to watch this movie, but it certainly helps. What are your first impressions, non-spoiler first impressions of Mank and everything that goes with it?
Well, to get back to your first point of watching Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Okay. This is, I know. Yeah. You're calling me an expert. Well, I'm one of the, yeah. Okay. Well, I have true confession time. I watched Citizen Kane for the first time last night, which was after watching Mank. So
nice.
I mean, it's on everyone's best list or, you know, those that matter, you know, and I'm like going in. Sometimes I have, I'm reticent to see those films because I have such high expectations. So, but yeah. I watched Citizen Kane last night and it allowed me to get a little bit more of the backstory behind the story of Mank. So, yeah, but to me, Mank was a film about the film industry, for the film industry, and its most dedicated or ardent fans. So it's a story behind the story of one/the most lauded films of all times. And it takes the task seriously and is more than slightly self-aware, but with good results. I think.
All right. Jay, what are your first impressions?
I agree 100%. My thoughts were after watching this, I thoroughly enjoyed it myself, but I said, this is a movie for cinephiles. I think Gary Oldman's performance and just, you know, the person character of Mank is absolutely a captivating character. And you just like want him to be doing things and being the smartest guy in the room / drunkest guy in the room the whole time, that you could enjoy it. But I definitely felt like this was a movie for cinephiles. And I went in with kind of the expectation that you said, oh, this is a behind the scenes thing of Citizen Kane, which that in itself didn't really rock my boat, but directed by David Fincher, starring Gary Oldman. Sign me up. I could care less what the story is. You got those two. I want to see it because I love both of those guys. But I really enjoyed it. And I do think I told you I was going to also rewatch Citizen Kane yesterday, but with a child just a touch over a week old, I just kind of randomly fall asleep in places now. So I failed to watch it again, but I have seen it. And
but you have seen it. See,
I have seen it.
So I'm like going, I can check that off the list now. And thank you for not being too mean to me. Okay.
You know what though? I would say most people haven't seen that movie. Most people know that movie, but I bet most people haven't seen it. I think it's
I think they're the lucky ones. Oops, did I? Oops, sorry, sorry. I won't go there. I won't go there because I know I can be in really big trouble.
Or if they've seen it, they've seen it in the wrong way, I think. I don't think I said this. Lou and Jeremy and I recorded a Front Row Classics episode on Citizen Kane, I think almost 3 years ago now, but on that podcast, and I still stand by it, a lot of people get introduced to Citizen Kane in like classrooms during class. And I don't think watching it 4 days in a row, cut up into little half hour segments is the right way to watch any movie, especially one like this, where the narrative constantly goes back and forth, which is the way it is with Mank. I mean, a lot of the way that Fincher, structures this film is structured very much in the way there's little Citizen Kane Easter eggs in the movie too, that if you are well enough familiar with it, you might be able to catch. But I think part of the reason why Citizen Kane has such greatness is because there's a fascinating story behind the story, which this somewhat captures. There was another movie which I've mentioned to some people on the Front Row called RKO 281, which was done by HBO in the late 90s, and it's more of a straightforward making of Citizen Kane movie, and you've got John Malkovich as Herman Mankiewicz in that movie, and it's a very different portrayal than Gary Oldman does. But I think when I first heard that Gary Oldman was cast in this role, I think Gary Oldman's a brilliant actor, but for a person who died at the age of 55 and Oldman being in his early 60s, I'm like, oh, maybe there's some miscasting going on here. But I think he pulled it off very well, and he really pulls off a guy that really was self-destructive, but you could see why he was invited to every party in Hollywood.
Yeah, definitely.
I would counter argue too with the age thing. People in 30s, 40s, 50s. I mean, he's 60 now, but that's what, 45 back then. I mean, I look at pictures of my grandparents. I'm like, how are my parents the same age as me? My grandparents look 20 years older than my parents do at the same age. So there is that element to it too. Okay, I wanted to riff one thing off of the thing you said about Citizen Kane, seeing it wrong. Mm-hmm. I think that was a really great point because it is like a classroom movie at this point. But I also think people don't understand the context, you know, of why that movie's so important. You know, because it looks so modern.
That's true.
People, the fades, the cuts, the storytelling that's not completely linear. Right. These are all things that were not at all in existence when it came out. So I think you have to have the context for why that all movies now look like Citizen Kane because of Citizen Kane.
You have to look at every other movie made in 1941 and then look at Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Because
I could tell that it was groundbreaking, you know, and that sort of thing. But yeah.
And it is a movie that demands repeat viewings. And also, I think for some reason, when you get called the greatest movie ever made, people like to treat it like homework when they watch it. And it shouldn't be homework. It's a popcorn movie like any other movie, I think. And that's how I got introduced to it. And I think I was one of the lucky people where I just viewed it as a regular movie when I saw it. And so it really, so I always see it differently than other people when I watch it. And, but this movie Mank, I think kind of, I think if you haven't seen it and aren't familiar with it, I think this movie will give you a little push to want to see it, depending on. So Brett, I don't want you to feel like I'm not going to get mad. What were your opinions of Citizen Kane since you viewed it for the first time?
Briefly. I knew that it was groundbreaking because I did, a little bit of research and, camera angles and story and the way the story is told. I was very impressed that Robert Wise was the editor. I'm like going, that's very impressive. And to have worked with Orson Welles when you're an editor, I'm like going, oh my gosh, that would have been a hard task, I'm sure. But I think that it was very sort of modern, and I took that for granted. And there were certain production aspects that took me aback a bit. I know that, you were taking someone who was, 25 or 24 at the time of filming and making, them decades older. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to, get some moisturizer and go here. Cause I'm just like going, old does not necessarily mean dry, but they were all kind of across the board. They all had kind of the same look, but I'm like going, the same person must have done makeup for Clint Eastwood in his movies too, because, Clint Eastwood directed movies because he doesn't spend a whole lot on makeup and it shows. But anyway, that's an aside. But I'm glad that I watched it. I think it probably is something that I would want to watch again to see if I can get a little bit more out of it, but sure. Those are my semi brief thoughts.
Sure, yeah, and I would encourage, because our job here is to discuss Mank, so we're not going to get into too many details about yes, Kane.
Right.
But if you do, Jeremy and Lou and I did record that episode. It's still in our classics feed. If people want to go back and listen to it, we had a pretty good discussion, and it was right very close to after the 2016 election when a lot of things seemed very relevant with that movie.
Oh, yeah.
So we,
and this one too.
And we will get into that too. But yeah. Brett, we didn't get to you. What are your thoughts on Gary Oldman's performance though in this film?
Seamless. I'm like going, effortless, an incredibly complex character and life situations that he just embodies in this, sort of dance. I don't know. It's just, it's like he's had, a cocktail to loosen him up, and, he didn't stop there. But it was just, it was wonderful to watch his performance. And there are, a number of others, but we'll get into the casting and all, because I have some, observations or thoughts about that, but sure. I just thought he was amazing. I'm just amazing. More so than anything I've ever seen him in, really. I mean, it's just effortless, which we know takes a lot of effort. So it's, that's pretty good. Once you can fake that, that thing. Yeah. So anyway,
Yeah, it does. And this is really, it's a huge cast, but it's really a performance piece for maybe one or two or three people. I feel like it's everybody else is kind of satellites around a few different characters, but he pulls it off so amazingly well. And it seems like everything's almost made up. It doesn't even seem like he's reading a script. It seems like he's living that. And I'm sure most of that credit goes to Fincher, because the whole look of this movie just captures that era. I never felt like I was, it's been a long time since I've seen a period piece of this time period where I felt like I was there watching those people. And this movie really does that for me. Because I think more than anything, like we said, it's not really a making of Citizen Kane movie. It's really a slice of life of that time period with just this story as the backdrop. But yeah, I think, Fincher masterfully make, and it's a beautiful looking movie.
I think in addition to that, the way he recorded the sound, because at first the sound was, it threw me off.
Yeah.
It sounds like a movie.
It's recorded, in mono.
And it was, I was like, this is absolutely beautiful. And, but the sound sounds really dated. And honestly, I only really noticed it for maybe the first 3 or 4 minutes. And then that observation totally went away. And it was, I think that helped. It took me out at first just because I wasn't ready for it. I didn't realize. I was like, what is going on with this sound? I couldn't quite pinpoint it. But then I think that adds to that aesthetic of that time period. Mm-hmm. Because as I stopped noticing and it felt more natural into it. So I think that was another really creative way to build that time period.
Yeah.
Well, and I think I texted you, Brandon, that it had the timing marks for the end of the reel and the start of the next reel. I'm like going, you know, I'm like going, whoa. I'm like going,
that's I love that.
Some serious detail that was so cool.
You know? According to David Fincher's Fight Club, we call those cigarette burns, right?
Yeah.
he references those in another movie, too.
He does.
That's the only reason I know what those were.
Yeah. At first, when I saw the first one, I was like, what happened there? And I went back and I'm like, oh, he's acting like he shot this on film. And
at that time too.
Absolutely.
I mean the car scenes and all of that appear to be projected and all of that. The other question I had, does Day for Night really work ever? Did that really ever fool anyone when they were filming Day for Night? You know, I'm like going, my, it's a bright moon.
I don't think it ever really fooled anybody, but I think it gives it, it works really well in black and white. It gives it this kind of silver sheen that nothing else can do. Cause I'm thinking of there's a sequence where Mankiewicz and Marion Davies take a walk around the Hearst estate. That's when it most stands out to me. And there's a whole lot of old Hollywood techniques done in this movie. You know, there's a lot of matte paintings in this movie and there's a lot of soundstage work. And I think it all works really well and it doesn't feel static. It still feels cinematic to me when I watched it.
Somewhere, I was reading one of the reviews said that it was, you know, more of a pastiche, which I'm like going, okay, maybe borderline pastiche. But I think it's done with such reverence and love that, you know, as a cinemaphile, you can enjoy that rather than find that as, you know, a deterrent to the quality of this film.
So. Yeah, I found those elements very inviting, personally.
Yeah, my
in the middle of a pandemic when times were better back in the past, you know. So, you know, well, we'll give them that, you know.
We're longing for the days of the Depression.
Oh my gosh, probably not. But yes, no. I get it. Yeah. So, oops. Be careful. Oh no, that's another wish. It's another wish. You're gonna get. Never mind. That was another behind the podcast thing. Sorry.
Yeah, my one concern, and you brought it up, Jay, was. I was so engrossed in it, but it's because I'm familiar with all these people that they're referencing and I know all the players. And I thought if a casual Netflix viewer watched this movie and decided to watch it, would they turn it off about halfway through? Because would it seem like a foreign language to them? Like, because it never stops to explain who Irving Thalberg and Louis B. Mayer and Ben Hecht and all these people are. But I think I don't think it ever alienates, because I think you can kind of figure it out on your own, but I don't know. I think maybe that's my one gripe with the movie. It really spoke to me because I know all these people, but is it going to attract more of a universal audience because of a lot of these unfamiliar names nowadays?
I don't think it is.
Okay.
But I don't think movies about Hollywood are what mainstream audiences want anyways. Right. I think I enjoy those movies because, you know, like all of us, we're all cinephiles, man. We don't like the movies only. We like the history, the evolution, and just what Tinseltown was and how it evolved. And I think for any cinephile, they're very interested in that. But But I think, and that's why I think filmmakers as a whole are really obsessed with this, you know, this very certain periods of time in filmmaking. So I personally don't feel that there's many movies about old Hollywood that are tailored to a mainstream audience. Maybe some that are like in that time period, but not about the movies.
I'm thinking
Confidential or something like that.
Or a biopic about somebody that everybody knows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know that it alienates just the casual Netflix viewer. But I think that it was nice not to be told who those people are, you know, backstories on all those people, because that would have made it, you know, very, very much longer, interminably longer, don't you find? And, you know, and I'm like going, I was looking through the IMDb for the cast, and I'm like going, And there's slight of a mention, you know, who these people are, but a lot of them, it's not. You don't know who they are, but you know that they were in the room where it happened, to cross metaphor. I'm like going, sorry, that's part of our lexicon now. So, you know,
cause I was looking through the cast list and I'm like, cause it was saying like, I'm like, well, Bette Davis was never a character in this, but it says somebody plays her.
She wasn't at MGM to stand up with the group saying, you know, I'll take a pay cut. She was never there. So
she was at Warner Brothers. So,
you know, and I'd read somewhere that the part where, and I'm sorry, are we into the movie yet?
Well, yeah, we can.
Segue.
We'll start with your thought on the next one. But any other generalities before we move on to specific scenes?
Nope.
All right. Well, for those of you who want to go and watch the movie now, we will give you that chance, and you can come back and listen to this part. But we will start spoilers now. But so, Brett, continue on with your discussion.
Oh, this is just—it's a kind of a minor point, but it was just a really cool point where Mank, Herman Mankiewicz, was being, well, shall we say, dropped off / literally dropped off at the train station. And I think that, you know, it was in a convertible. It was kind of fancy and all of that. But I think that it was Joan Crawford. Crawford was dropping him off, because there was like, and I, when I watched it the second time, the autograph seekers are going, you know, Miss Crawford, I think, I'm not sure, I might have made that up in my head, but you know, so Mankiewicz was barely there, and so was I. But anyway, so I don't know, you know. Yeah. So.
Well, now that we're getting into specific details of the movie, though, the one thing that kind of got me by surprise was how little Orson Welles as a character was in this movie. He only gets a very little amount of screen time. I mean, whenever Tom Burke, who plays Welles, who I think does a great job and gets the voice and all of that, he really makes his mark when he's on screen. Like when they do the first shot of him sitting next to Mankiewicz's hospital bed, I'm like, is that a hologram? but no, it wasn't. But it was. But yeah, he really gets it. And and it really sort of set the tone for me that this isn't necessarily going to be a Kane story. This is everything surrounding the making of that and what led to him writing that screenplay. But yeah, there are so many different aspects of Hollywood at that time that go into this. Jay, we'll just start with you. What's either a scene or one of the aspects of the movie that you wanted to highlight?
I guess the aspect, just some of the dialogue, I think from Mank.
Wow.
I like how that time period they speak. I'll say a little more aristocratically than we speak. Mm-hmm. Anybody speaks nowadays. You know, they just sound very like a socialite. They sound very intelligent. And I just love Gary Oldman just always sloshing around a drink, literally sounding like the smartest guy in every room he's in.
Yeah.
but also like he might say something that he's going to get in huge trouble for at a moment's notice. And I lived in a small town, and I think what I really captivated me about Mank is it reminded me of my grandpa, and that like everyone in Hollywood knows Mank. Everyone knows him. He knows what's happening everywhere. And then the top, you know, the higher brass, who's that guy? Who's that guy?
Yeah.
But everyone else in the world knows him. And I don't know. He's such a captivating character. And I think his dialogue and the way he said things, and it was just, he's such a captivating character to watch. So I really liked the dialogue. I think they nailed the vernacular of the time, and just Gary Oldman delivering those lines, man. I could have gone for the extended edition myself, Brett, if long as it was more Gary Oldman.
Yeah, right. Yes. No, that's fine. Yeah. Well, I think that, yeah, the dialogue was amazing. And is it, let's see, according to IMDb, it was Jack Fincher's first script writing effort.
This is,
I'm like going, is that this, correct?
Yeah, David Fincher's dad, who passed away some years ago, this was a script that he had been working on several years before he died, never got to finish it, and his son has finally finished it for him. But he still gave his dad's sole screen credit for the screenplay, which is ironic compared to the ending of this movie.
Well, yeah. Well, I think what was so cool about it is that, you know, specifically the dialogue that I liked was, well, rather specifically, but at least this character, Herman Mankiewicz's dialogue was so good. I mean, Mank has to suffer fools for that seems to be the Hollywood way, to suffer fools, but he does seem to suffer fools gladly with copious amounts of wit and liquor, but he seems to throw his friends like, okay, bouquets of bonbons, it seems. He's so clever and so charming, but his wit is more often used like word venom. It's a weapon, you know, like to castigate the elites with his observations, you know, and they give a lasting sting. So I just like that too. I mean, you know, I loved all of that. So I thought that was amazing. So that was the dialogue was just rat-a-tat-tat and just so cool. And he just says it's ever so casually, you know, and as you said, it does get him into trouble at times, but mostly it endears him to everyone.
Yeah, there's
Hurst,
people,
you know.
We all know people like that, right? Like, I don't think I'm that person, but we all know like some person who says things that like could really hurt people, but everyone's like, oh, that guy, he's so funny. You know, like they're able to get away with it because of some quirk of the person, and he has that.
Yeah. For me, the two scenes that stayed with me when this was over were the two big party scenes of the Hearst Castle. The first one being when they're all sitting around the fire talking, and you know, everyone, they're having this political discussion, and Mankel every once in a while will just interject something, and you know, Hearst will just laugh and shrug it off like, oh, there's my silly court jester that I invite here, you know, all the time. And then of course the final one where he goes and he's drunkenly confronting everybody, which is, you know, one of the most intensely, you know, awkward scenes, you know, that you can even imagine. But yeah, it just amazes me. This guy had been washed up for so long, and yet he was still invited into the inner circle just because he amused everybody. So, and you're in a world where, and I think it still happens in Hollywood now, where if you're not in the in circle, you don't get invited to these things, but he was still invited, even though he wasn't necessarily in at the time.
Well, and how he got the invitation, that part of the story was so interesting. You know, it was this casual sort of thing. You know, I'm going up to my aunt's. Do you want to come along? You know, I'm like going, sure. You know, as he falls out of Joan Crawford or whoever it was, you know, convertible, you know, and makes it up to the, you know, there, and apparently wakes up in the room going, where am I? And then, you know, madness ensues. But it was very cool. But yeah.
Yeah, so let's, Brett, so Jay discussed the dialogue. What's one of the aspects of the movie that stood out to you?
Well, I think the placemaking for the costuming, and the sets, you know, the whole production design. But I think, you know, this a scene that, that I really enjoyed was probably made that much better, and it actually completely took me away, was the scene in the writing room when the new guy comes into the and then basically has to show him your stuff, kid, you know, so he literally, you know, has to think on his feet. But we are going through the names, you know, of Ben Hecht and, you know, all of those, you know, it was Ben Hecht and
Charles
George S. Kaufman and all of those, you know, and I've seen pictures of those people and they got the look and everything so right that, you know, and then again, doing my research, I'm like looking at their IMDb pages and they're looking at contemporary actors and they are completely, you are completely transported to that time because of the costuming and hair and makeup and production design, which, you know, I know that's the magic of the movies, but it still kind of, you know, makes, they even give awards for those sort of things. But anyway, it just was so cool. I really enjoyed those, that aspect. You know, so I enjoy that so much.
Yeah, the world that it paints of California in the 30s. A lot of times when we see movies that take place in that time and place, it seems very fairy tale. But I think I feel like this is the one that got it fairly accurately, it seems like. Mm-hmm. And especially with the politics of the time. And when I went into this, I didn't realize politics was going to play so big into the movie, but there's that whole subplot with Upton Sinclair, who is played in a cameo by Bill Nye the Science Guy.
I know. When I saw that, I'm like going, well, he did look familiar.
Yeah.
I didn't like going, catch that.
Wow. Oh, yeah. I had to go back a couple times, but yeah.
Bill Nye the Science
but
Guy.
Yeah, going, but yeah.
Stellar.
But yeah, it focuses on the 1934 gubernatorial race between the incumbent and Upton Sinclair, who most people know. I think in high school we learned about The Jungle that he wrote, you know, and he ran on socialist tickets but decided to run on the Democratic ticket this time and was close to winning, but didn't quite win. But this movie goes into fake news because there's because we hear about the newsreels that a lot of these studio heads were making to create false narratives about Sinclair. And of course that leads to a character's untimely suicide and all of that. And man, it I don't know how far away the screenplay was written, but man, is it relevant to the current landscape we're living in?
Yeah, I've noticed that about a bunch of movies this year, you know, that have come out. And I wonder, was there intention behind the movies to mirror some of the current events? Or is it just that movies just tend to mirror our current events and it was just happenstance? Because that's exactly what I thought, especially once you get into those politics. Like, and that's, you know, that was an interesting thing too with Mank, because then you really kind of saw he does have like an ethical code that he follows, and it very much bothered him that they were hiring actors to do commentary, which I'm thinking like, my God, what would they think about political ads nowadays?
Yeah.
Well, or the conventions or whatever. But I think the problem was that it was kind of his offhanded remark that started all of that, which, you know, he kind of felt ownership for the idea that they took his offhanded remark and, you know, created, you know, campaigns built on that, you know. So I think that was also a problem for him. So,
yeah, and I need to go back and read, because I tried to read a few articles about what was fiction and what was fact here. And I think that, and apparently like the fund of Louis B. Mayer trying to get everybody in his studio to donate money against the Sinclair campaign was true. But I've read some people that say these newsreels didn't happen, but you know, it's you know, Hollywood myth or whatever. So myth and fact always coincide together in some of these movies. But I want to talk about, let's talk about some of the cast members in this movie. And Brett, we'll start with you. Who's one of the ones that either you want to praise?
Well, do I get yes. Amanda Seyfried?
Yeah.
Which I hope I didn't say incorrectly, but Amanda, you know.
Yeah.
Seyfried.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, sorry, Amanda, darling. I love you very much. I mean, just jaw-droppingly wonderful. I mean, she has never had this opportunity, you know, in Mean Girls or other things that I've seen her in. And I haven't seen all of her films, but what a wonderful opportunity. Because this cast, I mean, they're only, you know, from... You know, from the cinephile's point of view, only a couple that I really knew, you know, the others just looked familiar, you know, are known, but not especially well known. But her Marion Davies was so, it was so complete, you know, that, because I think, you know, in the film, Citizen Kane, her character, or the character that it's quasi based on, is, you know, is not anywhere near as put together as she is. Oh. So that's unfortunate for that situation, but it does make for a good movie in Mank. But yeah, her, it's just amazing. She lights up the screen in all of those Hollywood sort of starlet ways, but then she also, you know, brings a little bit more humanity to Hurst, you know, and that she really does love him and all this. I thought it was just an outstanding part for her. And when we get to the Oscar nominations, you might hear her name again.
I did not. If I didn't know she was in the movie, I wouldn't have known who that was.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, I thought. I mean, it looked like her, but her hair was different, and just the way she was, you know, done up and as the character.
And that she was so good.
So, that's exactly why. That's exactly why. I don't think I ever thought she was a bad actress, but I think you're right. She's just never had
the opportunity. I
don't think she's had those roles where she's had some scenery to choose. She's always, and she seems like one of those actresses too that's been kind of on that fringe of really pushing into a bigger stratosphere in the Hollywood circle. But she was phenomenal. I, the first few times she was on, I didn't know who it was. And then once the light hit her a different way, never would I have. Yeah. I thought she was phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah. She's never been an actress that I have necessarily praised for anything that any work that she's done. I don't think it's her fault as an actress. It's just the material she's usually given. But she was, for me, you know, certainly Oldman, but she was the little jewel in the movie that I felt came out of it. And I can't believe the resemblance she bears to Marion Davies when I looked at pictures. And she looks like she fits so well into those movies. But you're right, Brett. I love how she creates this. She's not Susan Alexander in Citizen Kane. And I think that was always the point, you know. And she even, and the final scene that she has with Mank, where she goes to visit him, where she has, you know, seen the screenplay and all of that, you know, I think she knows it's not her. It's what the public always imagined her to be. But this was a bright woman who genuinely loved Hurst from all accounts, and gave up a very promising career that she could have had to be, you know, beside Hurst. And, you know, she was his mistress, and his wife would not grant him a divorce because she was a devout Catholic. And so she lived with him as a mistress until he passed away, I think in like the early 50s. So this was someone who could have, you know, we'd be talking about in the same breath as maybe a Betty Davis or a Joan Crawford or somebody like that, but just who was never given the opportunity. And I think Seyfried really gives her that depth of, man, there is such an intelligence here, but such an allure. And yeah, you can't take your eyes off of her when she's in a scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Jay, is there a cast member that sticks out to you?
Yeah. I don't know that it was a standout performance, but I think it was a very inspired bit of casting, having Charles Dance play William Randolph Hearst, just because he just got done being the leader of the Lannisters on Game of Thrones. So if you want to, like, and I'm sure that's not why he got it, he's a great actor, but just this guy who has this intimidating presence over many seasons of one of the most popular shows of all time, and then making him, just by default of seeing him in that role, if you're familiar with Game of Thrones, you automatically go, who's this guy? You know, it, just because he's been doing it for the last, well, I mean, we're a little past Game of Thrones now, but I thought that was a very inspired piece of casting, having that connection there. So I thought he was really good. Arliss Howard, who played Louis B. Mayer, I thought was good. You know, I had to look him up. He's definitely a character actor that, you know, he's definitely a that guy actor that you've seen a bunch, because I saw him like, what do I know this guy from?
Yeah.
You know, he's so, you definitely know the face. He was very good. And I also thought, hopefully I say this, Tuppence Middleton, she played poor Sarah, Sarah Mankiewicz. She's not in it a whole lot. But I thought she was her juxtaposed in the scenes with Gary Oldman. Those are some fun scenes and some interesting scenes. Their relationship dynamic was really interesting. You know, she talked about his platonic mistresses, which I thought was a really interesting concept to bring up about their marriage, where he befriends these beautiful young actresses, but doesn't, nothing past that, but he tends to share a more emotional bond with them than his own wife. Mm-hmm. So I thought them competing, I don't know, competing and battling their relationship out, but in very intelligent, sophisticated ways. I thought she was a really good yin to his yang in the few scenes they had together.
Yeah, I really liked, he has such a bond with Marion, and that never bothers Sarah. And, you know, she's always confident in their relationship. And I always think that's so interesting. But yeah, all those people that you mentioned, you know, really give solid, there's a lot of great character performances in this movie. I also really enjoy Tom Pelfrey as Joe Mankiewicz, who is Herman's brother, who their relationship is always interesting to read about, because they were very similar, but they didn't get along that well. And Joe Mankiewicz, I think, later went on to have the career that Herman always wanted, because Joe won several Oscars for movies like All About Eve and A Letter to Three Wives. And he directed, you know, Guys and Dolls and The Ghost of Mrs. Muir and some really, really good movies. And then, of course, directed the movie that bankrupted 20th Century Fox, Cleopatra. But
well, you know,
you can't win them all. But Joe had more of a stable, I think Joe could handle his alcohol better than Herman could, and that was probably chose
that as his coping mechanism. Yeah, because, you know, he saw that in his brother, perhaps, you know, because they were probably, yeah.
But I love how their relationship is portrayed in Mank, because there is an animosity there, but there's also a love. Like when, you know, in their very last scene together, when he said, it's the best thing you've ever written. And, you know, and that's the last thing he says. But there are some wonderful character moments between relationships of certain individuals.
And they're like mature relationships. You believe, you know, the husband and wife situation and the brother relationship there, because it's very complex, and it's like, you know, they have a backstory between them, you know, it was just good. I enjoyed that very much.
Yeah. Let's talk about certain scenes that might stand out to us. Brett, is there one that stands out to you?
Well, we've talked about all three of them. the writer scene, the Mank and Marion Davies scene, which we get a glimpse again of, you know, the Hearst, you know, castle, you know, with its menagerie, its zoo, and all of that, you know, and those are, and we just get moments of that, you know, of how grand it was and all of this. And it was such an event to be invited there. But those scenes, and then when he got real with his brother there at the end, you know, that was the other scene, the I'm sorry I didn't have any others, but those were That's the right. three that I really, really much enjoyed. And there were so many others that I'll leave for someone else since I got the Amanda Seyfried. You know, it's only fair, Jay, that you get that. So your turn.
Jay.
Oh, we've talked about some I like yeah. too. But I think kind of the first one was when he went on the Western movie set. Because I think that's the first part of the movie where you kind of get a little more insight into Mank. And I'm far less familiar with you know, him as a person than you, Brandon. So I thought it was really interesting because the first thing Louis B. Mayer says, who's that guy? You know, oh, that's Herman Mankiewicz. He's a writer. But then Herman's the one who walks all around the set freewheeling too. Nobody's like, don't do that. He just hops on in the middle of one of the set pieces. He the executive producer who happened to be, William Randolph Hearst, you know, they're hanging out and talking. And I don't know. It's where you're just like, this guy is just a charming dude. Everybody knows him. You kind of see too. He bounces from this person to that person and gets little tidbits of information too that, yeah. you know, he kind of stores in a bank for later use. And so I really liked that scene a lot. And then that ending scene at that we mentioned at the Hearst castle where he drunkenly goes off on William Randolph Hearst, or as he calls him, Willie. And Louis B. Mayer, and it was, just he's super drunk and it is awkward, but part of it also felt a little Shakespearean to me, you know, in a lot of ways. So I that scene was really powerful, especially the end of that scene where after he rips into him, Louis B. Mayer's like, you putz, yeah. he pays you. He is yeah. your financer. What are you doing? And the yeah. look on Mank's drunken face as he goes a little, you know, dead in the eyes, like, what?
Yeah, soul crushing, just a little. Sorry. So I'm going to crush your soul now. My court gesture. You did not know that. Gesture. Sorry.
Well, in the best parts, what does William Randolph Hearst do? Very politely walks him to the door, calls him a ride. You've had too much to drink. He doesn't even, like, my take on it was he didn't even take it seriously.
Right.
That's my drunken jester, you know.
Wow.
That's what's going to happen from time to time. Yeah, and he didn't even care. And then, you know, I don't know a lot of these Hollywood names. I know the name Louis B. Mayer. And when he is kind of kissing the ring, like, oh, wow. Yeah, and then he doesn't even care. Doesn't even really seem to care that this guy, because he doesn't take, which I think makes the writing and creation of the movie Citizen Kane, you know, basically about William Randolph Hearst, all the more powerful. You know, what are people, even people that haven't seen the movie, you ask somebody about William Randolph Hearst or Citizen Kane, which one have they heard about now? You know, so it was kind of interesting. This powerful man brushed him off. But in the end, well after Mank's lifetime, you know, it's had a much more bigger impact, at least in pop culture and the zeitgeist, than I think some elements of William.
We can thank Patty for keeping the name alive. Anyway, so.
Yeah, the thing that stands out to me in that final scene at Hearst Castle is when Mank is really rubbing into Hearst about, you know, you were very similar to Sinclair when you were young. You had the highest ideals and fought for the little guy, and somewhere that all disappeared. And of course that ended up being what Citizen Kane is all about, of, you know, a man who gains the world and loses his soul. But yeah, it's the way that he reacted was, yeah, very. And you sent me yesterday, Jay, an Edgar Allan Poe short story, Hop Frog.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to tell me about that? Just how you found that connection?
Yeah. It, so like in junior high and high school, you know, I got all the chicks reading Edgar Allan Poe all the time. But Hop Frog is like, it's my favorite Edgar Allan Poe story because it's so shocking. And it's about a court jester who this king, you know, and I'm some, I didn't have time to reread it. It's been a while since I've reread it, but it's the king's favorite court jester, and he likes to poke at him and prod at him, but he wants him at all his events to entertain and jest and all this stuff. And then after many, many moons of the court jester just taking it from the king, he plots his revenge, and he gets the king to participate in one of his court jester routines. And it ends very, very grisly. He has the man dress up in a gorilla costume and hangs him from the ceiling and starts building it up. And then he lights the king on fire and walks out of the castle. And that's the end, but that's Citizen Kane. That's the lighting of the king on fire.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Some of my favorite scenes, involved.
So good, by the way. Thank you for that. Wow. like, let's put all of this together, shall we? Thank you.
Yeah. Some of my favorite scenes involve Arliss Howard as Louis B. Mayer, because of all of the Hollywood moguls, he's the one I've read about the most. And I never feel like anything like when I watched Judy last year and some of the other movies, I'd never felt like he's been captured the way that he's been written about. And he was not, from all accounts, he was not the predator that some of these other studio moguls were. He was a megalomaniac guy who loved to guilt people. And I think that that's perfectly shown in the scene where he goes in and does the whole crying jig to get all of his people to take less of a salary. And if you read about it and you watch interviews with people, that's what he would do. He would call meetings of all the contract players and just cry and sob about how they were all his family. And he would pay them back someday. Of course he never did, but he would put on a show basically. And, I watched an interview. I forget. I think it was Esther Williams or somebody like that who said that he used to have some kind of seltzer that he would put in his mouth, and to get somebody to do something, he would throw himself on the ground and cry and foam at the mouth to get people to do stuff.
Oh boy. And, okay.
Yeah.
And that's a good management tool. Oh my gosh.
And so this was the first time I've ever seen that really. Really sort of portrayed in that way. And then the death of Irving Thalberg, which was interesting because it kind of showed them that apparently they did have kind of a father-son relationship, but there was always an animosity there. And when you saw Louis B. Mayer get his handkerchief, and then when he gets into the limo and he throws the handkerchief out the window, you know, because now he's the sole head of MGM. He doesn't have to share it with anybody. That's the perfect sort of symbol. And I think Arliss Howard plays it perfectly because he does play this, you know, huge megalomaniac studio chief. But then when he does get in the presence of Hearst, he kind of shrivels up a little bit.
Diminished.
And I think that he plays that really well. He's kind of like Hearst Bulldog because Hearst doesn't have to do anything. He's got all the power.
Yeah. Well, I guess I had a question about Irving Thalberg. Thalberg. I should know how to say that again.
Oh, that's all right.
I'm a cinephile. I know it all. Just kidding. Anyway, was that, you know, he was the boy genius, and yes, you know, he made amazing contributions to stories and everything, and was truly amazing. But did he, I mean, were some of his talents just he also knew how to play the game, you know, from someone you know, I'm asking you, Brandon, that, you know, who as their little resident expert, well, our amazing expert who knows so much.
See, that kind of surprised me because and all the documentaries and stuff I've seen, that was never the thing. It was always Mayer was always the wheeler dealer of the two, and Thalberg was the artistic one. He was the creative one. So that was a new portrayal to me. I'd never seen that before. Okay. I don't know if they did this just to suit the story or not, but nothing from what I've heard.
And then he casts his wife.
He married
in great parts, but I'm like going, well, you know, there's probably a good reason that that Norma Shearer was cast in those roles. It just happened, you know.
She married the boss. Good.
You know, yeah, if that wasn't a political move too, but, you know, hello.
Well, then after Thalberg died, Norma didn't get any good parts again. So.
Really? Well, but she was gorgeous, and she was misrepresented by the actress who played her, I think. But,
yeah.
You know, I'm a Norma Shearer fan, so.
So.
There wasn't a whole bit, there wasn't a whole lot for Norma to do this time around.
Right. Yeah.
So
can I go back to the Thalberg's funeral scene too? Was really, I thought, intentional and interesting about when that scene happened. It was right after, and I don't remember the character's name, the one who recorded the political ads and then later saw what happened and committed suicide. It was right after his suicide.
Yeah.
So you kind of are led in to believe it's him. Then it's Thalberg, which I think does a really great job of, you know, kind of showing power versus dismissing, you know, some of the bit players. Cause that's, you know, that was the only reason he took it to do it was a first opportunity to get in a director's chair. Mm-hmm. So you think you're going to his funeral and then it flips gears. Cause I was like, oh, this is a pretty big funeral for this guy. Yeah. I was like, oh, this is not, oh, they don't care. They don't care. And I thought that was an interesting way to show that, by showing somebody more powerful's funeral,
you know,
right,
you know,
after his suicide.
And the scene right outside of his funeral that I think captures Hollywood probably perfectly is the scene between David Selznick and Mank when they are out smoking or whatever. And he goes, I haven't seen you forever, Mank. He said, I want you to come by and pitch me a script. And Mank's like, I've come in three different times and I haven't gotten past your secretary. He's like, oh, well, good to
your
see you.
Secretary's secretary. Yeah. You know, and then he goes, yeah, I know. Bye.
Yeah.
Slightly dismissive. I'm like going, oh, but yeah.
Yeah, man. So yeah, so many, yeah, there's so much meat in this movie and it's all these little wonderful scenes. The other thing that gets me about this movie, we've already talked about the look of it, but I just the black and white that they use, and you mentioned this to me, Brett, I wish I could see this on a big screen, and maybe eventually we'll get to at some point. But there's so much rich detail in the black and white and so much going on. But I just love the way that Fincher, you know, stylizes everything, and I love that all the different scenes and the time and place he does, like he's writing a screenplay, you know, time of day, all that stuff. It's so every detail in this movie is so well thought out.
I agree.
Yeah. Amazing. I'm a big Fincher fan. He's interesting to me because I think he is a world-class filmmaker who made a lot of genre stuff early on in his, you know, Aliens 3, Fight Club, The Game.
And so many videos.
Yeah.
You know, I was looking at his IMDb too. I'm like going, oh my gosh, Madonna. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that was his start was a music video director. So I think it's interesting now that he's in a position where he can do, I think, the stuff he has been for a few years now, but do the stuff he wants to do. He's a director that I think elevates whatever he has. The movie The Game with Michael Douglas is ridiculous. It's a ridiculous movie and should not be as entertaining as it is and as watchable as it is. Gone Girl, I know Craig's probably going to get off on this because he likes that kind of literature smut that lady writes, but it's a soap opera. He directed a soap opera and it's phenomenal to watch. So I think him getting his hands on, you know, now did Sorkin with The Social Network, and now he's done this. And I think now that he's getting the material that I think fits his high caliber of filmmaking, I think I read a thing where he wished he made more stuff. He's pretty disappointed in his output, but you don't have to, as long as you're putting it out like this, I don't take your time.
Quality over quantity, as they say.
Yeah.
And you work with Madonna. Come on. Oh, please. Sorry, just kidding. I'm sorry. That's the pop culture reference for me. You know, like my cinephile, yeah, that's fine. But the pop culture thing, Madonna.
But Madonna.
Okay. Well, before we get into the Oscar talk, though, we've been pretty positive. Is there anything that doesn't work in the movie for you, Brett?
I think the question is, who is this audience? Who is the audience for this film?
Yeah.
You know, I'm like going, it's this time of year, you know, where, you know, the serious movies come out, you know, we have the summer, normally we have summer blockbusters and that sort of thing, those tent poles and all of that. But now's the time for serious films, but it's so, you know, I said that it doesn't really explain all of these people, and you either have to, you know, do some research on your own or be familiar with that time period, as a lot of people are. But if you're just a casual viewer, you know, are you going to be engaged by this, or were you, you know, find it just, you know, boring? I don't know. I don't think it is. So that's why I, you know, questioned who the film is for. But I think, you know, I think it has a wider range than just, you know, the cinephiles and the industry people. I think that, you know, we'll see what it does on Netflix. I hope it does well. But
yeah. I think I should clarify my remarks from earlier based on how you said that. I think if people get into this and they get past, you know, get into it for a little bit, I think they'll be captivated. But are they just going to turn this movie on? You know, I think that's where the problem is going to lie with getting this in front of the right viewers.
It's an Irving Thalberg movie. I love The Insiders. I'm like going, it's rather specific, you know, so.
But I will say, with, you know, I mentioned Fincher having that kind of genre background, he's a director that when he's directing stuff, you know, people want to watch it. And man, I love Gary Oldman's kind of the same way. He's all over the place with movies. Right. I think one of his best performances is from a genre movie, and Fifth Element's like my favorite performance from Gary Oldman ever, you know? So I think I think they could get him in there. I think it's the cinephiles who are going to seek this movie out. And if I think you're right, I think the dialogue is so whip snap and funny and sharp and kind of stinging, like you said, Brett. I mean, I think if you can get into that part, you'll want to watch this movie all the way through. I don't think I had any problems. The only issue I had was just the sound at first. But once I understood it and got into it, I didn't even notice it. That'd probably be my only critique, but I thought it was a thing that actually sucked us in more the further in you got.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, and people have to realize, I know some people don't like the non-linear storytelling where you go back and forth. And so if you can get over that, and I know that it drives me crazy, but there's still people who have hangups about black and white.
And if you wow.
I know several people who won't watch a black and white movie, but huh. You know what? To me, black and white gives me even more of like a fantasy world than color does, because we live in color. Black and white mm-hmm. sort of takes me to somewhere that doesn't even exist a lot of the times. So I think people also have to get over the fact it's not a linear making of Citizen Kane movie. It's a slice of life. It's a time and place movie just set against that backdrop. But I think most viewers will be captivated by it. I know there's going to be some people who won't want to give it a chance, but I think if you do, you'll really, yeah. if Brett can give Citizen Kane a chance.
See, I did. Oh gosh. Now, you know, I'm going to be wrecked over the coals for that one. I'll watch it again with an open mind.
Sorry, Brett.
No, that's okay. No, that's it.
Oh, I'm just saying.
Making my apologies to all the cinephiles out there. I'll work harder. I will. I'll work harder. It'll be my favorite, maybe.
I think, too, Fincher, with that nonlinear storytelling, he does a really great job of helping you understand where you are by how either good or crappy Mank looks. Like, the further on in the more modern narrative, the crappier he looks. Like, it just looks like hell the more, you know, modern it is. And the further back, the sharper he looks. He's not all, you know, alcohol sweats and depression. he's rough when he's holed up writing Citizen Kane.
Yeah, He really
was. Was the situation correct in that he was in an accident and all held up in the hold up? Anyway, that he was bedridden while during that riding, you know, which kind of forced him to do that. Was that
the whole accident thing was true? I don't know how. I think he and Wells worked together a little more in the same place than what it's showing, but I think they needed to give him, you know, more of a way to reflect than he would have if he were just, you know, straight working on something.
Storytelling device, yeah. with less Wells. Good. I like that one. Thank you. Thank you for giving me that, because I'd rather watch the zingers and all of that and his memories rather than...
Because we've seen projects about came from Wells' point of view, so this is the first time we've gotten Mank's point of view. But
I think if you have too much Orson Welles, too, I mean, I think he's just one of those characters in our culture that is there's more of a mythos around him. You know, he's more of a mythical person than he a real is. Person.
Yeah,
and I think the more he's in, I think the more it takes away.
From
Mank, and then you watch Mank, and you're like, he seems like the mythical person. He's like a drunken demigod in Greek mythology, just sloshing wine around and making fun of everybody dumber than him.
Yeah, and the way this movie ends with, you know, the two of them not giving the other credit for what they did on the screenplay. It ends with animosity, but I couldn't think.
And humor, though. But humor,
it does, yeah. You know? It really does. It really does. And it's so interesting that that's, you know, here it's the movie that's called the greatest film of all time, and that's the one Oscar it won, the screenplay Oscar. So yeah. It's
really the greatest film of all. Okay, I'll work on it.
Well,
you have a
kid. Let's talk about the problems.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so let's talk about the actual Oscars that this film could be up for.
Okay.
Jay, we'll start with you.
I think Gary Oldman, Best Actor, is a shoo-in. He's not even going to be on the outer edge. I think you're right. I think you'll see Amanda Seyfried in there. Seyfried, however we say it.
Seyfried. So like going, if you do the German pronunciation, Seyfried. I got the last part right. You pronounced the last E. I'm like going, it's that, you know, EY. Sorry.
I think you'll see her in there. I think you'll get, we'll see what else has come out. I think you'll get Best Picture, Best Director. I definitely think this is going to give Sorkin a run for its money in Best Screenplay. If it's Best Original Screenplay. I know Craig mentioned that maybe the Trial of Chicago 7, because it so much was taken from court transcripts, that it could be adapted screenplay. I don't know. That would be interesting. But if they're running against each other, I would never bet against Sorkin. But, man, I think I preferred the banter and the dialogue in this to the Chicago 7, just because that's very much Sorkin's idea, you know, ideals and his down your throat. Whereas this is, it seems a little smarter. It's not Mank shoving his ideas down your throat. It's him being witty and making you think about situations and how things are done. And so I think it's got a strong chance there, and I'm sure some of the cinematography stuff, and Brett mentioned the costume design and things like that, I think you could see it in for. But I don't know what else is yet to come. Of the ones I've seen that I think, you know, might be in the running, which I think everything's just Netflix, right? It's all Netflix at this point for the most part. I think you got the Five Bloods in there. Trial of Chicago 7. I mean, I think those are kind of the other two that I've seen, that I've heard stuff about that are out. I liked this one the best of those three so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brad? That's my best guess, but I'm not an Oscar guy, so I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think it's going to, I think, it's kind of like there are some films that are termed Oscar bait, with derision, you know, for their kind of overreaching or their, you know, their kind of grab for awards. But, you know, Mank is certifiable Oscar bait in the best possible way, because it deserves recognition. And I'm thinking, you know, it's going to sweep the categories for nominations, You know, it's, I mean, everything, cinematography, you know, score, the score sort of disappears, and that's usually a good thing. And I didn't see who did it, but probably someone really good. And, you know, the guild is, you know, he or she will get nominations from his or her peers. So, you know, it's just, it doesn't try to be an Oscar film. It is an Oscar film or an award season film. I have friends who are part of the Screen Actors Guild and all that. So, you know, there's a little bit of a, a thing there between, you know, if you just say Oscar, you have to say all of them. So, so I'm trying to make everyone happy. I love Citizen Kane. Okay. So thank you.
Yeah, I don't. Brett, you're right. I don't think some movies are trying really, really hard to win Oscars. I don't think this movie's trying. Like we said, mm-hmm. Gary Oldman, his performance just exists. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's effortless. And the same thing with Seyfried. I'm just like, you know, those two will definitely be nominated. I think the fact that Oldman already has an Oscar and I haven't seen Ma Rainey yet, but with so much wind behind Chadwick Boseman's back, I think that'll right. be the, you know, not only the sentimental favorite, but also with the screenplay, I thought about it with this having been written by Jack Fincher, who passed away, never got to complete it. There might be sentimentality besides for the screenplay win for him too, which
that'd be amazing.
Yeah. So yeah. And the cinematography, I mean, it is a beautiful movie to look at. Mm-hmm. Fincher, I think, gets a Best Director nom. You know, we'll see what comes down the pike. So it'll be an interesting race. I mean, most of the time we can predict, but we haven't seen necessarily what's all coming yet. So
what do you think? You've seen Trial of the Chicago 7. Have you guys both seen that one yet?
I saw Trial of the Chicago 7, and I've seen Hillbilly Elegy, too.
I haven't. I've heard.
Okay. Okay. The much maligned Hillbilly Elegy. Please. You know, you can only be as good as your source material. And that was a questionable decision. Everyone, you know, but the actors are really good.
Yeah,
the source material is questionable.
I mean, Amanda Seyfried will probably have competition with Glenn Close and Amy Adams. So. That will be.
I don't think Amy Adams is going to get it because I don't, you know, because they, you know, if you listen to our Front Row Network review, that she's not given a chance. The audience or the Academy or the, you know, seasoned voters, you know, as I like to say, you know, I'd be surprised if she's not nominated for an Oscar. She might get some other nominations, but there's just no way to show her some love. I'm like going, someone please get that woman an Oscar winning role and Glenn Close too. But I don't know if if you had Amanda Seyfried and Glenn Close, Amanda Seyfried. If you had Amanda and Glenn up against each other, who would you choose?
I love Glenn Close, but I don't know. I don't know. Maybe Glenn will have to wait another year.
So Sunset Boulevard, yeah. I'm like going, please. But I'm like going.
Well, the dialogue that Glenn Close has to give in the trailer about Terminators is enough to make me think Amanda. Could Amanda go in as a best supporting?
Yeah.
I would really, put her
Gary Oldman's the only leading. Stuff gets a little weird to me with.
Well, they make the decision, and this is, we love you, Netflix. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to view this prior to its release, but. I think they're really wanting an Oscar. So they will, do they decide or is it, they're the ones who would decide who's up for things, wouldn't they?
Yeah. They're the ones who submit for nominations.
Well, they're going to have a lot of options this year. So,
and I've been, and I know Lou Hare's been saying this too. Delroy Lindo in The Five Bloods is amazing. He's another one of those actors you've seen in a million things, and he just like hits a home run. So he's, and that's another Netflix movie. So I think I know they're pushing him for best actor, even though it's very much an ensemble movie, just like Trial of Chicago 7. I said, how do you pick up an actor versus a supporting actor? It all gets a little fuzzy.
It gets heady, but we will, we'll see what happens. So as we wind down here, we will just give our final thoughts, recommendations for Mank, and we'll start with Brett.
Give it a chance. Wherever you come to this film as a fan of films or a casual viewer, give it a chance. And if there's a question, if you have a question, this is Netflix. You can pause it, go do your little Google research, and come on back. So, yeah. So it's very worthwhile and a gorgeous film on all accounts. Acting, yeah. Everything. So, yep. If we did thumbs up, I'd give you the thumbs up. But I don't know what our rating system is here. So just go see it. So, yeah. A must see.
Yeah, I agree with Brett. It's not like you're not watching this movie with your phone out anyways. Get your phone out. Do a quick Google. It is. There's lots of references in this movie that I thought were great. Reference to like the Grouch, the Marx Brothers tearing up an executive's office. There's references to Philip Marlowe. Shout out to Brandon Davis and his episode, The Big Sleep. Well, that's going to be on Classics. So I thought that was, there's definitely some really on point pop culture references for the time period that I thought were great, but I agree.
Charlie Chaplin on piano, isn't it? Charlie Chaplin on piano.
Yes.
Yeah.
And hello. Throwaway.
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, it was great. So I really liked it. Like I said, of the movies we're already talking about where there's potential Oscar stuff, I got to say, I think this was my favorite one. I found it absolutely captivating. If you're a fan of, you know, Fincher, or Gary Oldman, or old Hollywood, definitely, definitely give it a shot. But the dialogue in this alone is enough to – that just for the dialogue, you need your phone out to Google words and stuff. You know, it's, this movie, if you want a movie that's going to talk down to you like I think most movies do nowadays, this is not the one. This movie does not talk down to you. The expectation is it's going to elevate you to look stuff up, be more knowledgeable. And I like that. I like a movie to force me to reach outside my comfort zone. So I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I agree with Brett. Even if you're not a cinephile, worth a shot. And I do want to get in a viewing of Citizen Kane because I do think I got in the first few minutes and already I'm like, these are great companion pieces. These movies are great companion pieces to one another.
Yeah. It's a great, if you want to be transported back to another time and place, this is a great movie to watch because you are enveloped from the very beginning, just with the way people speak and with the way it looks. And I hope whether you end up liking it or not, I hope it pushes people to give Citizen Kane a try if they haven't. And I hope that it opens up people's eyes to, you know, even not Kane, but, you know, if you want to look at movies that some of the other people mentioned in this did, it's a great sort of gateway. But
I was going to say that. Go ahead.
But yeah, with an amazing performance by Oldman, I think a star-making performance for Seyfried, because I know she's been around a while, but I think this is going to open up doors for her in other ways. And just some wonderful character actors who never usually get their due, but do some wonderful work like Charles Dance, Narlis Howard. I would have anybody, you know, give it a try because I think that you're going to come away really surprised. So as we sort of close out here, I'm going to ask you two what you have coming up on your respective shows. Jay, what's coming up on Flashbacks?
We are going to do the 35th anniversary of Clue.
Nice.
And I think currently we have 72 guests scheduled to be on.
Ooh. Well, I'm that trying would be nice.
To figure out how to do a dinner theater review of and everyone gets to be a character from the game.
Oh, wow.
A little murder this Christmas. That's fun.
The episode.
Brett, what's coming up on Beyond the Mouse?
Let's see. Well, in December, we have a number of sort of holiday and Disney. Yeah, Disney holiday. Excuse me, Disney holiday themes. We have a Jungle Cruise game. Review, and we're calling it a kind of our gifts for the Disney loving person in your world. So we're talking about that and some other. Actually, a lot of we're highlighting a number of the books that some of the people that have been on our podcast this year, which has been kind of amazing. Let's see. Oh, and we have a special treat for Christmas Day. Legendary, and in fact, Disney legend. Rolly Crump, who was responsible, an Imagineer, Disney Imagineer, who was responsible for a number of our favorites, The Enchanted Tiki Room, and he did a lot with the 1964 World's Fair for It's a Small World, and he calls himself a beatnik, and yeah, he was very interesting to interview. So that is on Christmas Day on the 25th. And then we have our 2020 wrap-up, which is going to be following our Christmas episode. So we've had an amazing year with really some great guests that we're very happy to remember this year.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what's coming up. So.
Yeah, well, for classics, Brett very soon is going to join Eric and I. We're going to talk about Anti-Mame, one of the great comedies, and also Nice to Watch Around the Holidays. And then Jeremy will be joining Eric and I to talk about The Great Race, a fun comedy to watch with the whole family around Christmas. And then also Lou and Eric and I got to discuss The Godfather 3 for Guilty Pleasures last month, and the new Coppola cut comes out December 8th. So the three of us are going to review it and see if it's any better of a movie this time around. So hopefully we get a nice Christmas present there. But yeah, so a lot of fun stuff coming up. This has been a strange year, but I think one of our best years in terms of the front row. I think that we've knocked it out of the park with all of this stuff. So a lot to celebrate at the end of the year, despite not the year that we were hoping for. So as we close out, we hope that you all go and watch Mank this holiday season. I think it'll be a nice treat. So to close out, I am Brandon Davis.
I'm Brett Rutherford.
And I'm Jay Hoffman.
And we will see you in the front row.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio Illinois. For more from the Front Row Network, including our articles or our other dozens of shows, visit thefrontrownetwork.com or nprillinois.org/programs/frontrownetwork. You can also find us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram, and on Twitter @FrontRowReviews with a Z.